Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zeslofsky. Join me today in a trip above the clouds to find some softness, a little gentleness, and perhaps a regular dose of headspace. This is episode number 40. Hi there, guy, gal, kiddos, or any non-humans that happen to be overhearing my words. I'm intentionally keeping my tone somewhat even and my comments measured right now because I don't want to create a glaring juxtaposition between the literal and figurative tone I set for this episode and the calm yet invigorating words of my guest, Andy Puddicombe. I won't get all robotic on you, though. And there are some laughs ahead, so look forward to that. But you know what? The topic of mindfulness, meditation, and headspace that Andy and I discuss are in total alignment with something that I actually haven't mentioned for a few episodes. What's that, you say? Well, it's Simple Rev, the two-day simplicity event that Dan Hayes of Simple Life Together fame and I are organizing. Now, we have been busy nailing down some details, like deciding on the dates of October 3rd and 4th, 2014, and a venue of the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, Minnesota, my fair city, for the very first Simple Rev. I'll have a link in the show notes at valueofsimple.com/SASM040 to the Simple Rev website if you want to learn more and potentially get involved in our collective upcoming grooviness. For now, let's just jump right into it. You are about to hear Andy and I discuss how to be familiar and comfortable with living in the present moment, why we're so baffled that people don't care about their minds like they look after their bodies, the fascinating, fascinating science behind meditation, and many benefits, plus some really cool ripple effects that regular meditation will create. So what do you say? Should we, hit it? Here we go. Well, hello, all you Smart and Simple Matters listeners. You know, I have never had a former Buddhist monk or circus performer on the show until today. That's because Andy Puddicombe, the co-founder of Headspace, an admired TED Talk speaker, and the prominent author of books like Get Some Headspace, is my guest. Now, I'm going to let Andy tell you how he and Rich Pearson created Headspace the company in 2010 to help millions of others get some internal headspace of their own. I'm also going to leave his backstory of traveling to Nepal and India and a whole bunch of other places in pursuit of a mindful existence up to him. But you should know that Andy's mission with Headspace is to demystify the practice of meditation and help as many people as possible integrate it into their daily habits. There's a ton of recent scientific research on meditation that is striking, and he's going to break down some of it for us in a way that may have you getting some headspace of your own before the day is done. So what do you say, Andy? Should we get this started?
Let's do it, Joe. And thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you here. Well, we're going to start where we normally start, which is what I call the seeds of awesomeness, so that people can get a better understanding of where you come from and why you are who you are today. Can you tell us maybe one or two things about the environment in which you grew up, or maybe a particular event in your childhood that helps us understand where you've come from and why you are who you are now?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I grew up in Southwest England, and I think certainly if you look at Headspace now, there's one defining kind of moment, I think, and that was when my parents got divorced and were going through quite a difficult time, and my mom was looking for a way to kind of relax a little bit more and get away from some of that stress, and she signed up to a meditation class when I was probably about 10 or 11 years old. And not wanting to be left at my sort of on my own at home, I bugged her to go along with her, and I guess that started off something, you know, which is still very kind of relevant today. And I kept it going for a couple of years, and then other things kind of took over, as they do, as in teenage life. And I came back to meditation sort of in my late teens. But I would say that was definitely a defining moment in terms of the direction of my career or vocation as I know it now.
Did you have certain challenges that made you feel like you should or needed to give up the practice of meditation? Or it was just something organic, like you said, that young kids do when they find something else that's new and shiny?
Yeah.
And different?
You know, I was intensely sporty, very social, going to parties and hanging out with friends on my BMX were far more interesting than sitting on my bed doing my meditation as I had done for a little while in my early teens, you know. So, it wasn't kind of, there was no real challenge of, other than just like most people, struggling to sit still for the time was probably about 20 minutes or so. And as a young lad full of energy, I struggled with that a little bit, but that was really more to do with, I later found out that I just hadn't really been taught in a way, that allowed me to deal with that, to cope with that well, you know. So I find even now the challenges that I faced very early on really useful when teaching meditation, because I've gone through most of the challenges that people write in and say, hey, I'm really struggling with this. And I'm like, hey, you know what? I struggle with that as well. Here's the best way to deal with it. And so we often joke, Rich and I, that
you're co-founder, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Rich is the co-founder, and I often joke that the only reason I'm able to teach is because I've made every single mistake you could possibly make along the way. And as a result, you know, it makes teaching a lot easier.
Yes. Going to the School of Hard Knocks is an awfully good teacher for giving you the opportunity to instruct others, whether it's to experience some of the things that you have so that they can have a better appreciation of what it is they will ultimately do, or to avoid some of the pitfalls that we have each fallen into. Maybe can you walk us just a little bit further into the future? We've talked about some of your youth, and I know that and you've said this a lot of times before, but for a new audience, you talk about in your early 20s about how you're midway through a sports science degree and you're leading this very typical life. You said that you're very sports oriented and energetic, and then all of a sudden you decide to make this big shift. What was that?
Yeah, I was studying sports science, and I was competing in gymnastics at a reasonable level. Still intensely interested in the body, but becoming increasingly interested in the mind. Just before I set off for university, a few things kind of happened in my life. I was in a group of people that got crashed into by a car, drunk driver, and a couple of the group sort of died in that accident. Very soon after, my stepsister got run over. She was cycling, and a guy fell asleep at the wheel, and she died.
Wow.
And I think these things, and something else as well, but these things kind of came together in a very short period of time. And I'd gone away to university, yes, because I was interested in that stuff, but also because I was probably sort of running away a little bit from those things that had happened in my personal life and didn't really know how to deal with them. So I found kind of for a little while, for a year or so, it was possible if I drank enough and socialized enough, it was possible to get away from those feelings. And then eventually it kind of came to a head and it was just like, wow, yeah, this isn't working out for me. I really need to address kind of how and why I feel and not constantly look for distraction and run away from how and why I feel. And at the time, Joe, I was going out with a lovely young lady who was very interested in Buddhism, and she talked to me a lot about kind of these monks and nuns in Tibet and the Himalayas. And I don't know, I was probably about a year and a half into the degree, and one afternoon I just thought, yeah, I'm going to do it. And I went into college that afternoon, and I handed in my notice and left and set off about three months later to northern India.
And eventually you became an ordained monk at a Tibetan monastery, right?
I did, yeah. I actually did. I spent quite a bit of time in what's known as the Southeastern sort of Asian schools of Buddhism first in Burma and Thailand, training as a novice monk. And eventually in time, yeah, I spent some time with a teacher in Russia as well. But eventually I ordained as a Tibetan monk in northern India, yeah.
All right. Well, that gives us a lot of context. So what a lot of people refer to as meditation and what researchers may call mindfulness, when we're talking, because we're going to be talking about a lot, when we say headspace, you're basically talking about the same thing as meditation or mindfulness, right?
Yes and no. I think in the broadest possible sense, yes. I think it is worth just separating them and just looking at each individually, because I think there's something really useful in that. So I would say mindfulness, in the broadest sense, the ability to be present in the moment, no matter what we're doing or where we are. So that could be, it doesn't have to be meditating. It could be cooking a meal. It could be eating a meal. It could be walking down the street or driving the car. But essentially being present in the moment. For most of us, that tends to kind of, that quality, that feeling tends to come and go in life. We would like to experience it more often, but we don't know how to. So we spend a lot of our time sort of distracted, lost in thought. So in order to learn how to be more mindful, we need an exercise, we need a skill in order to learn how to be familiar with the present moment. And that's what meditation is. When we actually take ourselves away from everyday life and say, right, I'm going to sit down undistracted with my eyes closed and just learn how to be more present. And then the resulting feeling that comes from that, of being present, being more aware, having a softer, kind of kinder mind, I would describe as headspace. So it's that feeling when we feel very light, very spacious. The analogy we often use at headspace is the idea of kind of the blue sky. And you know, for anyone who's been in a plane, you'll know even on a cloudy day, you can fly up there and the blue sky is still there. Mm-hmm. I would say the same of headspace. Headspace is always with us, but often we kind of forget about it because our mind's so clouded with all the thoughts and all that kind of that running commentary that tends to go on in the mind. So by meditating and learning how to be more mindful, we can experience more headspace.
Now, I know that headspace is a number of things to a number of different people. You're not just a singular company that does a thing, but one of the primary ways in which people know you is your meditation app. And last I checked, there were over 600,000 users of the Headspace app. Is that?
Yeah. Okay. So we've had, I think it's significantly more actually. Rich would be a better person to ask. We know we're closing in on a million people who've done Take 10 now. Which is the first 10 days of the Headspace app. So some of those people use it online, sort of on their desktops. And yes, we've got a lot of people using the app as well.
So what is Headspace? Can you tell us?
Well, Headspace is certainly more than an app. I mean, we think of it more in terms of a mission, a movement, encouraging a happier and healthier world. Certainly as an organization, kind of our primary kind of goal, if you like, yes, is to demystify meditation and get as many people in the world as possible to sit down and to take a short period of time each day to look after the mind, which I don't know about you, Joel, but for me is, you know, when I really kind of sit and reflect, that is the most precious resource that I have. You know, I'm dependent on it for every single aspect of my life. Especially my relationships that I have with other people. So we're kind of thinking that when we can get meditation to a point in society when people consider it no different than brushing their teeth, taking a shower, going for a walk, like that's when we'll have achieved our mission. And we decided a long time ago, we started off doing events and we were reaching, you know, large numbers of people doing events. But we had so many requests from overseas, from people who couldn't come to the events, asking, you know, do you have any podcasts? Do you have any? That we started to create some digital content. And one thing led to another. And before we knew it, we had sort of 300 or 400 hours of content that I'd recorded and put together as a course. And we decided to launch the app probably about a year and a half ago now. So in just a year and a half, we've got a lot of traction and a huge amount of support. And I have to say, like, we've never advertised, so it's all word of mouth or editorial. The press have been fantastic for us, both, well, media all over TV and print press. But especially that word of mouth thing, you know, when someone tries it And it, you know, it makes a difference in their life. And then they tell their family and their friends. That's our favorite way of it getting around.
Well, let me ask you. So there are a lot of people who are listening here who may think going for a run for an hour every day is a good thing. Mm. Or maybe they work out 3 times a week at the gym and that's worth it to them. But sitting, although you don't necessarily need to be sitting to meditate, we might talk about all the various activities that you can do while also meditating at the same time.
Sure.
What about those people who are unconvinced that they should spend even a small amount of their day to do it, but at the same time, they see the benefits of all of their physical activity? How do you convince people with maybe it's with a specific benefit or two that is most persuasive to them?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the individual. In the broadest possible context, you could split it out into three, let's say, kind of health, performance, and relationships. From a health point of view, you can break that down into the physical health benefits, such as lower blood pressure, better heart health, better respiratory system, higher immunity. So these are all, by the way, these aren't kind of... These are hard scientific facts, and you can find them. You can go onto our science page on our website at headspace.com and, you know, look at the papers where these have been published as well. So you've got kind of the physical health benefits. You've got the emotional health benefits, such as reduced anxiety, reduced depression, increased happiness. And then you've got the mental health benefits. So it's so broad, but there's great research showing better working memory, better attention, better focus, less distraction, so less kind of rumination, if you like. So you've got all of that just in the health category alone. And then you've got kind of performance, which we find, we work with the British Olympic team, so we've got gold-winning Olympic athletes who've kind of hung their hat on Headspace and said, kind of, I would not have got it, kind of, had I not had that mental training. So whether it's performance, we have in the sporting arena, we work with a lot of large organizations as well, corporate organizations. For them, it's more about productivity, it's about efficiency, reduced absenteeism. And then there's this kind of middle bracket of relationships. And for me, this is the most interesting by far, Joel. You know, I think meditation is often seen as a very kind of solo pursuit. Some would even say selfish pursuit, you know, where we remove ourselves and take ourselves away from society. And I think for anyone who does even just a little bit of meditation, very quickly becomes obvious that, you know, we live in a world in which we are interdependent. You know, we don't live sort of separately from everybody else. When somebody close to us is unhappy, when they're unwell, when they're not in a very good mood, it affects us in a very real way. There's a kind of a ripple effect, you know.
Absolutely.
And the reverse is equally true. Like when we're happy and we're healthy and we're in a good space, that's not just good for us. That's good for the people around us as well. So if you start to look at that on a map, you know, and individuals and the ripple effect that that creates, whether it's in an organization, whether it's in a community of people, whether it's in a family, like that can have just an extraordinary kind of impact on the world, I think.
Yeah, well, I think you've ticked off about, I stopped counting after about 10, but I think you're on about 20 to 25 different benefits, all of a high degree of usefulness and appeal, at least to me. The one I was most surprised about, you haven't mentioned it yet, although it's on the Headspace website, which I'll link to in the show notes along with everything else we talk about, is addiction. Because I've suffered from a number of addictions, and you could say that I still suffer from one, a sugar addiction, which is very difficult for me to resolve. Video games used to be a major problem. I quit them cold turkey 4 years ago. But I'm kind of curious about the addiction piece. How will meditation, specifically the daily practice of it, help me either avoid or resolve some of the addictive tendencies that I might have?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, Joe. And I you're right. I don't always mention it kind of straight away. I think it's quite a personal thing for a lot of people, and maybe a little kind of even taboo still in our society, I think. It's really interesting because from a traditional meditation standpoint, it's talked about a huge amount. It's not normally talked about in terms of addiction. It's normally talked about in terms of craving. And we all crave things from time to time, every single person. It can be some, you know, it can be food, it can be relationships, it can be other people, a different environment. We all crave, but we crave like on a scale. you know. And there are certain things that we crave so often and that we indulge in so often that after a while it can become either psychologically addictive or physiologically addictive. So the interesting thing that comes out of mindfulness research is that within a very short period of time, in fact, after meditating just 20 minutes a day for 5 days, already the part of the brain which is associated with craving, already that is starting to power down. And within kind of several weeks of meditating 20 minutes a day, we're actually starting to see not only less blood flow in that area, but we're starting to see the neural networks change. So like we're talking not about some fluffy intangible change, we're talking about the brain itself. So it's usually talked about in terms of neuroplasticity. So the brain is not fixed, it is not plastic. Oh, sorry, it's not solid. There is a flexibility to it, there's a plasticity to it. And in just the same way as when we go to the gym and we train a muscle, and it gets sort of bigger and thicker and stronger, when we sit and meditate or we practice mindfulness, the part of the brain associated with happiness and feelings of positive well-being, the cortex there actually gets thicker and stronger. So we're talking about changing the shape of our brain. And whilst that's getting thicker and stronger and it's receiving more blood flow and we're spending essentially more time in that space, the parts of the brain which are involved with kind of craving and more negative type thinking, those are starting to power down because they're no longer receiving that blood flow. So this isn't something that kind of, you know, you have to go away and be a monk for decades or anything like that. Like this is something that begins to happen very, very quickly. And everybody can experience. I think some of the most interesting research that I've read about, and in fact I wrote a book called The Headspace Diet. It's not about necessarily losing weight, it's more about kind of our approach to food. And in there, the National Health Institute did some research, and within 4 weeks, people's craving, their binging, had reduced by 50 to 70%.
That is so significant. Sounds like the kind of thing that I need to pick up and check out. I bet there's a lot of people who are listening right now who are nodding their heads and thinking, okay, this guy's onto something here. I'm listening. but I know that there are a lot of obstacles when people first try to start implementing this into their daily practice to get some headspace. There's a number of common things that trip them up. Can you tell us, for the people who are thinking about getting started after they listen to us, what they should be looking out for that might stymie their efforts to get started with this daily headspace?
For sure. So, I mean, I think the first things that tend to come up before people even begin, never mind once they've begun, are all the usual thoughts, which are, I'm too busy to meditate. I can't find 10 minutes in the day. I'm too stressed to meditate, which is kind of ironic. My mind is too busy and all those kind of things. So I think that the starting point for that is, you know, what value do we place on our mental, emotional, physical health? Like, are we honestly saying that we cannot spare 10 minutes? And that's what we're talking about at the beginning. We're talking about 10 minutes a day. Are we saying that we can't spare 10 minutes in the day to look after our most treasured possession?
Which is our brain, mind.
Which is our mind. And without the mind, we're nothing. You know, we don't have anything. So it's such a kind of a vital thing. And I think once we recognize that, then we can start to prioritize and say, okay, yeah, life might be busy, but I'm going to find 10 minutes in the day, you know?
And so what else? So we've got time. I don't have enough time. Yeah. I'm too stressed to try to do this. Are there issues about self-worth? Like, I could never possibly calm my mind long enough to do it. What are some of the other ones?
For sure. I think that's a really good one, Joel. You know, like some people have given up before they've even begun, you know, and it's really interesting. I always say, kind of, look at meditation as a skill, right? Stripped of all of its kind of cultural traditions and everything else. Essentially, you have the skill of training the mind to be more open and more attentive, essentially more aware, you know. Now, we can all do that. Some people will start off like learning any new skill. Some people may be more inclined, you know, kind of start off finding it a little bit easier. But interestingly, they're not always the people that find it easy ongoing, you know, whereas other people might struggle a little bit to begin with and find that the mind's quite distracted, which is very normal, by the way, nothing to worry about, doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. And yet over time, they develop real genuine stability of awareness, openness, and focus. So I think that's quite a common one, thinking kind of, oh, I'm no good at this, it's not working. And that's really to misunderstand meditation. So right up front, meditation is not about kind of wiping the mind clean. It's not even about clearing the mind. It's about learning to be at ease with the mind, to be able to witness thoughts and feelings without judging them and without getting involved in them.
And so when, continue.
I was just going to say, when we do that, the mind naturally finds a place of quiet. It slows down on its own. And that is such a, it's a subtle, but such a an important and misunderstood piece about meditation.
So it sounds like people who go into this goal-oriented or who have certain expectations may be taking the wrong approach, that you're not supposed to achieve X by Y date of or by Z number of sessions. That kind of thing sounds pretty counterproductive. One of the things that I'm kind of curious about, and I know that this is of interest to you or to Headspace as a company, is engaging children in this as well.
Yeah,
I have two kids. One is a 3.5-month-old son. I think he's a little too young to meditate. Probably won't understand the concept very
bit.
Well. And then I have a son, Grant, who just turned 3 years old. How old do you have to be in order to start this practice up, either to be able to do it or in order to realize benefits? Is this something that, say, a 5-year-old could do?
Yeah, so I've worked myself in schools with children as young as 5 and 6. They seem to enjoy it a lot. They seem to get a lot out of it. We also get a lot of people writing in. The current Headspace app is not designed for children. It's important to say that. It's really kind of for 12 years and upwards. I would say most of our users are 18 years and upwards. But we get a lot of people kind of writing in saying, hey, look, we're doing this with our children, and it's sort of as young as 4 and 5, and seeing a huge amount of benefit. I think my favorite ever kind of quote that's come in from anybody, I mean, we get loads of stuff in, you know, but it was a mother who'd done it with her 5-year-old daughter, and afterwards she said, how do you feel? And the girl said, I feel soft. And I think for most of us, when we look at our life, you know, there's not a lot of gentleness in life. You know, I think it's something that most people kind of crave, a softer mind, a kinder mind, you know, and a bit of softness in our body as well. You know, it's there's something, I think, so beautifully innocent about her comment. So, I think certainly it can benefit children as young as that. I think it really comes into its own kind of around the age of 10, 11, 12. We're currently working on Headspace for Kids, and we'll be launching that as a separate app in the future, hopefully the near future.
Well, I know you said at age 11 you started it up, and you continue to go with it for a couple of years.
Yeah,
I'm sure it looks different for children versus adults, and even maybe for the elderly. Probably don't have time to get into all the nuances here, but.
Sure.
You touched on something before, and I'd like to come back to it a little bit in terms of you don't have to have this barren mental landscape when you meditate. And you can even potentially do other things, complementary things, when you do it. Some people might think of sitting down and drinking hot tea. Mm-hmm. That might be a common image that comes to people's mind. But what else could we do while meditating? Can we drive to work? Can we scarf down to lunch? Can I mow the lawn?
Well, I'm pleased you mentioned driving and mowing the lawn, because this is where I always differentiate, and I think it's really important to differentiate between meditation and mindfulness. So again, just coming back to the idea of mindfulness, we're still talking about the same thing, being present in the moment, focused on a particular thing, no matter what we're doing. Now, could you meditate while driving to work? I would say absolutely not, because meditation in the traditional sense usually involves closing the eyes to some extent, and usually involves either focusing on an internal object such as the breath or visualizing something. So I wouldn't recommend doing that while driving or mowing the lawn. However, I don't know, Joe, if you've ever driven to work and maybe, you know, like a mile or so goes by and then you suddenly kind of wake up. You know, it's as though you weren't aware. Like you've been just driven because you drive it every day, you know, there's maybe not too much concentration going into it, and suddenly you kind of wake up. And so that's a classic case of where we simply weren't very mindful, and where we could train mindfulness. So yes, we can train mindfulness mowing the lawn, doing the gardening is a lovely way to train mindfulness. It doesn't require anything special, you know. Essentially, all you're doing is focusing on whatever it is you're doing. And when you realize that the mind has wandered off, it's drifted off into unproductive thinking, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, there's thinking. Back to what I'm doing. Rather than getting caught up in that discursive state of mind, you know. Mm-hmm. And we can do that eating food. We can do it walking down the street. When you're walking down the street, are you thinking about a conversation you had last week? Are you thinking about what you might say if a possible scenario plays out the next day, kind of hypothetically thinking things through? Or are you present in the street, in your body, noticing the smells, the senses, the, you know, the things you can see around you? So the research from Harvard, which I mentioned in my TED talk actually, said that on average, our mind is wandering kind of almost 47% of the time. So almost half of our life, we're lost in thought. So we have the potential here to regain a huge amount of our life.
I bet. Well, I can just tell you today, earlier I was outside walking the dogs and walking along the city streets over here, and I was alternating between thinking about what was going to happen later today, some events from the past week, staring up at the trees and imagining the spring and the birds chirping. But a lot of the time, I wasn't necessarily just simply enjoying the environment, listening to my breath or looking at a cloud floating by, or just simply being present, like you were saying, and observing, not necessarily looking for anything or trying to do anything with the environment, just simply being and walking and enjoying. Yeah, that's a challenge that I have, where sometimes there's a thought that pops up in my mind and it's almost like a piece of paper where I need to crumple it up and just throw it away, so that I can get back to that state of, okay, I'm here, there's no agenda, I should be enjoying in the here and now, as opposed to constantly living in the present or the past. I certainly do that a lot, and I know a lot of other folks who struggle with that too. Yeah. What about you? You must have some challenges still, because you don't claim to be perfect, not that any of us do, but
certainly not.
How do you still struggle a little bit with the daily practice or achieving a heightened level of mindfulness in a consistent way?
Yeah, there's no question. I think this is a training for life. I don't think, you know, I was very fortunate. You know, I went away for many, many years and practiced meditation and mindfulness in a very conducive environment, very supportive environment. And there's no question that when you do that, you develop a certain amount of stability, which allows you to take that into everyday life. But even kind of my teachers who, you know, they train quite intensely in a monastery in the mountains for sort of 20 or 30 years, they would say they were still learning. So certainly kind of always more to learn. I think, you know, all the basic kind of ways, you know, I think when I'm quite fortunate in that I don't have a lot of routine in my work. You know, I think when we have a lot of routine, it can be quite tempting to sort of just do things habitually. We kind of fall asleep a little bit, maybe. I think when you go on holiday and you're in a new space, and it's like suddenly kind of you have kind of a new set of eyes, and you're smelling things, you're tasting things, you're seeing things, and maybe we even experience it when someone comes to visit us in our own space and we see our surroundings and our life through their eyes. And all of a sudden we become kind of more aware. So I think in that way, I'm quite kind of fortunate. But for sure, I still find myself getting, you know, impatient. I find myself kind of maybe overwhelmed with the responsibilities of my job and work. You know, it's if I think back to the last recording sort of schedule we had, so we're just bringing out version 2 of Headspace in the next couple of months, and for that I had to record just over 700 hours of content in, I don't know, five months, something
like
that.
Holy smokes.
So I was sitting in a box in Soho in London, you know, like a recording studio box in London. And by the time I reached, you know, kind of 500 hours or something, you know, like Yeah, for sure. You know, I found myself, not when I was in there doing it, but, you know, when I was approaching it in the day, I'd be thinking, oh, wow, another day in the box, you know, and setting up an expectation, you know, which is so easy to do in life. You know, when actually when I was in there, it was fine, but it was more the expectation of doing something. So, yeah, I, for sure, Joel, I still have plenty of challenges and lots to learn in every area of life.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you and I are similar in a number of ways. Like, I'm always thinking of how I can have more nothingness. There's this concept that I talk to my friends about, and I even had a podcast on it about nothingness, and about how sometimes the only thing that we truly need more of is nothing.
Yeah. What,
and normally that nothing is internal, not necessarily like a nothing, like a barren landscape around us, but it's a privilege. It's almost like a prize when you're just there. And there's nothing but you or your thoughts. Do you think in these ways too? Do you do something in particular besides meditation? Maybe an additional habit that magnifies the impact of meditation to have some more nothingness in your life?
For sure, you know. And it's interesting you use the word nothingness. So if you look at the sort of, you know, if you go way, way back and you start looking at the Sanskrit terminology and the Tibetan terminology, like of nothingness and everythingness. They're kind of part of the same thing, two sides of one coin. And I love that idea of nothingness because out of nothing comes everything, you know. So it's a place that isn't, although it's nothingness and it sounds really empty and barren, actually it is the seat of creativity and everything else we know. So I think for starters, it's an interesting space to be in. I still meditate every day, but the thing that I've, since moving to California, the thing that I try and do every day, every morning, I like to see the sun come up, and I go surfing with Rich, my co-founder, sometimes with my wife as well. And we'll go down to the local beach, and we'll surf. And it is it has the potential, like everything else, to be an act of mindfulness. And there is something beautiful about being in nature that makes mindfulness easy. You know, being in nature, there are dolphins and seals, and you're seeing the sun come up and there's mountains, and it's like, wow, what a way to wake up in the morning. But then when you kind of take that a bit further and, you know, start to see kind of the relationship between meditation and surfing, and, you know, kind of not needing to apply too much effort, but needing to apply enough effort. If you paddle too hard, you know, you overcook it and you fall off. If you don't paddle hard enough, you don't catch the wave. And then when you're on the wave, can you be comfortable simply being on the wave rather than kind of worrying about, well, what if I fall off the wave? And I wonder what the next wave is going to be like. So there are so many kind of ways in which the two things link up. And for me, it is just the best possible way to begin the day. And we're incredibly fortunate to be able to do that where we are.
So sunrises, meditation, and surfing. I could do two out of the three. There's not any good surf places in the Midwest of the United States. And I suppose people in London and Seattle, boy, they have a lot of cloudy days too. It might be hard to catch a lot of sunsets.
It's true.
And do a lot of surfing. So perhaps it's contextual like everything in life, but that's great. I'm sure other people, you've probably heard from a number of folks who say, I complement meditation with this and with that. The kind of thing that anyone can do anywhere that they are. But it's really cool to hear your perspective on it. I'd just like to ask you so far, I mean, we could keep going. And maybe even if you're available and the demand is high enough, there's a ton of other angles that I'd love to take. But we'll tone it down for now because we'll need to make sure that there's other things. And I know if folks want more, you are definitely available. As you said, your words, both written and verbal, have been published in a lot of different places. So there's no shortage of Andy Puddicombe out there on the internet. But is there anything that we did not talk about that you'd like people to know?
Well, I think, you know, this is a little bit old school. Maybe this is reflective of my age. You know, I don't know. I'm a little bit older. But I know digital is the way that everybody is going. And we're really happy to be able to offer an app which allows people hopefully to use technology skillfully, not using technology for the sake of using technology, but actually using the medium and the vehicle of technology to kind of unplug and unwind. But for me personally, I still love sitting down with a book And I do think, regardless of whether you're using the app or not, I think it works well both ways. The first book that I did, less so the Headspace Diet, I think that's quite specific, but the first book, Get Some Headspace, you know, listen, it's in, I don't know, it's in about 12 languages now, and about 30 odd countries. And I think sitting down with a book, it's a different way of learning, but my experience has been that for many people, kind of, it's still a really good way of learning, you know, although you don't get the guided meditations, which is why I say it's quite nice to combine with the app. There's a ton of stories in there from kind of being away, what it's like living in a monastery. And it's surprising, when I came to write it, I found that so many of the experiences there are just as relevant in everyday life. You know, our minds are with us wherever we go, and it doesn't really matter too much where we are in the world or who we're with. You know, there's that the mind is there with us, and we have the opportunity to train it. And I think the feedback to me has been from readers is that there is something very particular that's delivered through the book that, you know, is maybe a little different from the app.
All right. So two supplementary resources, the Headspace app and Get Some Headspace, the book. That's pretty cool stuff. So for people who want to find that online, I'm sure that they can find that, and I'll have links in the show notes. But for other types of resources, Andy, whether it's get more of you personally or get more of Headspace, the organization, where should we go online to find out?
Sure. Well, the best place to go would be to headspace.com. And on there, you'll find a link to, I think, just about everything you possibly need, whether it's the platform itself and a link to the app and a way of kind of using the service on your desktop. But there's also, as I say, kind of really good links to science and to kind of how it can be applied to teams, communities, organizations, and lots of other stuff on there. But if you do want to keep it kind of mobile, then yeah, it's available for iPhones and for Android. It's called Headspace on the Go, the app. And you can download it for free. What I'd recommend to anybody, you know, even if this is something you think, like, you know what, I'm still not convinced that this is for me, it's free to download. It takes 10 minutes a day. It starts with something called Take 10, which is 10 minutes a day for 10 days. And all I'd say is, look, give it a go. If it's not for you at the end of 10 days, fine, you know. There are lots of other things to keep us occupied out there, but give it a go and just see. It may not be what you expect.
Well, I hope that a number of people will try Take 10 after listening to this and leave some comments in the show notes and tell us about their experience with whether it's their first go or whether they're reviving old practice that they left a long time ago for some known or unknown reason. I'm very curious to see what people do and what their experiences are. Andy, I can't thank you enough for joining me on the show today. It's been a complete treat.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thanks again for having me on.
Hello again, friend. It's just me here to tie up this episode into a neat little bow. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling majorly calm, content, and comfortable right now. I think Andy naturally has that effect when he talks to people. And if you dig what he had to say, or if you're planning on doing something about it, tell us in the show notes what you think and what you're planning. There are a lot of people eager to cheer you on. And all you got to do is just share a little bit with us. You can find those show notes at valueofsimple.com/SASM040, along with links to the books, videos, and other cool stuff that Andy and I discussed. I also link to simplerev.com in the show notes if you want to discover more about our Simplicity community's exciting upcoming event. I hope you will get excited for the next episode's topic too. It's all about experience curating, and it will give you the context that you need to know if it's something you want. The public launch of Experience Curating, the book, is on February 18th, 2014. So mark your calendars, guy, gal, and kiddos. I'll need your support on the book pretty darn soon. But right now, I want to offer oodles and oodles of thanks for your support with Smart and Simple Matters. I'm just really honored that you listen to this episode or any other episode of the show for that matter. As always, you can feel free to leave a candid review of the show on iTunes at valueofsimple.com/iTunes, because reading what you think and need helps me bring on the right guests and focus on the things that truly matter to you. If you would like to share your insight somewhere else, you can send an email to joel@valueofsimple.com. Catch me on Twitter via @JoelZaslavsky, or hey, just go to Value Simple and look for all the other places that I and our community hang out online. Hey, one more thing before you're done listening. I just got to say, you rock. Yeah, you. I am talking to you. Now, with that in mind, go exercise your mind like you'd exercise your body. Drop and give me 20. Brain style, baby. If that actually made sense, I hope you'll flex that gray matter. We need you to. It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of All Things Value of Simple.